Rundahl contacted me mind to mind. Master, they send an emissary forward to negotiate.
Negotiate? That's unusual.
I think that's due to their leadership, Rundahl continued. They're flying the device of the mask.
The mask.
One of the more prominent human renegade war magi who had betrayed their species and gone to work for Shirul, the dead god. I'd heard all about Mask. Mask had been given a small army of his, or her. There was still a lot we didn't know about the mage, but we were pretty sure she was female, own, as well as lordship over her own little estate in the Penumbra. From what we knew, the renegades ran their armies and their domains like independent kings. They were advanced units, experiments in entrusting humans to fight against humans. One of them, Buckler, had ravaged through Gilmora last year during and after the invasion and escaped just as the kingdom's forces were closing in on him. Mask held a witchstone, I knew, but beyond that there was little intelligence on the war mage. The army below demonstrated the resources at her command, but we had yet to test her magical strength in the field.
Meet with the emissary,
I instructed. Find out what they want. If you need me, let me know, and I'll come down.
I've got this, Master,
he assured me confidently. I watched from above as a single Gervan came forward, about halfway up the narrow stair, and spoke to Rundahl. I considered casting a long-ears spell, but even that enchantment has limitations of distance, and I was 400 or 500 feet above the conversation. I didn't have long to wait. Rundahl was back a few moments later.
It was pretty standard surrender or die,
he reported. Don't they mean surrender and die?
More or less, he agreed.
They say we don't have His Majesty, the Goblin King's, permission to build a castle here. Would we kindly move it? That sort of thing. Or they will move it for us.
Interesting.
Do you think Mask himself is here? Herself.
Herself,
he corrected. They were clear about that. Mask is female, and human, and we're infecting her given territory.
I feel just terrible about that.
You let them know we're reluctant to move?
Very clearly, Master,
he affirmed. They seem determined to see us gone, however. How long did they give us? Before he could answer, I could see the first charge of goblins up the trail. They crossed the spot in which their emissary had stood, and the first in the rank fell over with arrows in them. That didn't stop the assault, far from it. But the first 10 Gavani who ran up that trail died in their tracks.
Not long,
Rundahl managed, as he shouted orders to his men. Never mind, I told him, I can see you're busy. He didn't answer because he was busy. I watched with pride as the boy who had been driven from his Wilderlands home 3 years ago thundered arcane death at the Gavani who had done it. Explosions, cascades of blue electricity, smoke and bolts of magical energy swept the oncoming swell of attackers and created a pile of bodies in the path. Arrows flew from his emplacement as the Kasari and the militia added their more mundane shafts to the carnage. More arrows flew from the points along the trail that had been hardened to protect archers, giving the goblins hundreds of well-fledged reasons to find better things to do. The goblins kept up the first assault for an hour that morning, sending one squad after another up the narrow winding path, and then watching them tumble off the side, an arrow in their gut or their eyes burned out by a magical flame as they approached the landing. Rundahl seemed tireless as he methodically applied a wide range of deadly and disruptive war magic spells. He dispatched dozens of the enemy without even drawing his blade, and his command over the archers was adept. I had to admit, I was impressed by how far the studious lad had come in his craft. It seems a shame to let all those goblins just mill around down there, getting bored, waiting their turn, I noted to Fundaris as we watched the battle from above.
I was thinking the same thing, the old foot wizard said philosophically. Never liked those scrugs, even when they weren't no more than chicken thieves.
He went over to check on one of the impromptu siege engines that Carmella had built during the night. It looked rickety compared to real engines, with the Kasari using their vaunted rope-tying skills to lash it together instead of nailing it as a proper engineer would have, but they seemed to hold together for the purpose. I'm certain there was binding magic involved.
The foot wizard spoke to the crew of older Kasari boys, and in a few moments, the first of many heavy stones was flung out into the void, and onto the heads of the massed goblin infantry below. One rock can cause quite a lot of damage. When the other two engines joined the fight, soon it was raining boulders the size of a man's head down on the goblins. We watched them scatter as they tried to avoid the deadly missiles, which was a lot of fun. But then we watched one well-shot rock suddenly veer out of the way a few dozen feet above the crowd, and our fun was done. Mask had cast a counterspell to protect her troops, damn her. Trying to fire our engines accurately was a challenge after that. Worse, she had further reinforcements arriving, goblins who did not wear her livery, but nonetheless seemed enthusiastic about besieging our new tower. They ran up the path with abandon, but fell just as easily as their friends had. That went on all morning. Just after noon, a Gavani priest managed to cast a couple of ingenuous counterspells, producing a smoking cloud that my apprentice could not dispel before it began choking his men. That allowed the Gavani to push Rondor's force back to the second switchback, but the 100-odd black, furry corpses they left behind showed the price they'd paid for the victory. All afternoon they pushed against his men, and their reinforcements. Rondor only yielded the path when he had to, and frequently pushed back down the trail in the wake of a Gavani defeat. By nightfall, when the real battle heated up, we'd only lost two men, and the second landing still held. Just before dusk, I had Dara and her Skyriders enter the battle. I'd kept them out of the fray to this point, and used them exclusively for patrolling, though the riders occasionally dropped something nasty on the infantry below. But when I ordered them to attack, the giant hawks sped in unexpectedly and began tearing havoc in our foes. They were very effective, tearing at the Gavani with their talons when they dove, then clutching as many goblins as they could and dropping them on the heads of their fellows from the air. Dara had a good rhythm to her attacks going. The Sky Riders made a point of diving with the sun behind them, making them all but invisible, until they were screeching and slashing. The goblins were perplexed, but some of their snipers managed to get some shots off during the avian attacks. Despite their size, the birds were difficult for the short bows of the Gavani to target. I called a halt after the fourth pass, however, as I didn't want them to master the ability. As darkness fell over the veil, the goblins redoubled their assault. They loved the night like we enjoyed the day, and saw as well by starlight as we did by the noonday sun, which is why it really messed with their assault when we hung huge, incredibly bright mage lights over their heads, providing our archers with the light they needed to see their targets while blinding the Gavani to dangers and threats. I'm just an asshole that way. Mask countered our magic wherever she could, but there was only one of her and a dozen or so of us. She was a good war mage. She had dueled Rondal to a standstill, negating several of his spells long enough to gain the first switchback, but there were just more magi on our side, and some of us were much better than she was. She tried a lot of the old standards, concealed climbers up the slopes, which we detected and deflected, swaths of darkness designed to obscure our aim, which we countered with more powerful spells. She tried to magically undermine the base of the tower from afar, but Carmella's enchantments on the foundation were resolute, and backed by Karshak's stone singing. The tower might have been fresh and more thinly walled than I was used to, but it had been magically hardened. It would take a lot to pull it down. Still, it was a long, loud, bloody night. Twice we had to send reinforcements down to the second switchback, and twice we repelled the besiegers. But it was hot work, and we lost six more men doing it. Many more were wounded. Ormar got a nasty cut on his scalp that promised an intriguing scar, and Landric had taken an arrow into the meaty part of his right thigh. But more than 100 goblins were piled before the second gate, trailing a long line of their fellow corpses down the trail, thanks to their combined efforts. Nor had they lost their morale when I visited them in the surgery tent. They both looked like they were on holiday, enthusiastically trading accounts of the battle, while Lelwyn and the other nuns saw to their wounds. I thanked them and made them get a couple of hours' sleep before they returned to the fray. All night long, we repelled the Gavani's every effort to gain the ridge. Sometimes hours went by without an assault, while other attacks dragged into nearly one-on-one duels on the pathway. The children's initial fear and excitement about being in a battle receded over the course of the day, and after singing a few Kasari songs around their campfires, they slept as normal, assured they would be woken if anything noteworthy happened. As dawn's twilight lit the sky, the goblins retreated back to the first gate and halted their assault. We thanked them by having Dara's skyriders strafe them with the long steel javelins they called skybolts and thaumaturgic glass spheres bearing berserker enchantments or other deadly spells. But the goblins had had enough for the night. They were ready for naps and a better strategy. I didn't intend on giving them the opportunity. I'd been using my witch sphere and the mirrors all night, trying to arrange some relief. The good news was that there was a company of Iron Band soldiers, 400 strong, that could be diverted from their supply mission to support us. The bad news was that they were at least 2, perhaps 3, days away. "We can hold out for 3 days," Penny assured everyone that morning, after we'd conjured breakfast from Tauri. "We're in a good defensive position here. It took them a day to take even one gatehouse, and they paid dearly for that."
"Not dearly enough," remarked Arborn, shaking his long brown locks skeptically. "They've left a tithe of their forces dead on the trail, but they've received half again as many in reinforcements. Heavy infantry this time. Hobgoblins, and bloody roots by their banner."
That was bad news. Not many goblin regiments were known by their names in Humani lands, but the Bloody Roots had a certain flair for brutality that made their name and terrible sign known even among their human foes. They were some of the best infantry the goblins had. A legion of eunuchs, fed on a diet of human flesh and genocidal hatred, the Bloody Roots were armored in black mail and great helms, wielding heavy iron halberds. Their reputation among us came from how the Bloody Roots had stormed one tidy country manor hall after another in Gilmora last year, and the terrible things they'd done to any prisoners they didn't think could make the journey north in chains. Lady Ithalia had nearly caught up with them during her cleansing of the region, but they had deceived her and slipped away. That's hard to do with one of the Alka alone, especially Ithalia, who was as sneaky and deadly as any Kasari ranger. The Bloody Roots were smart, well-trained and disciplined, as well as tough and brutal. I hate a clever hobgoblin. The Bloody Root was going to be problematic. That thick armor and those big halberds were a much different story than the light swords and darts the common Gavani soldiers bore. Arrows would be much easier for them to stand against, and they would be able to power through our defenses a lot easier. "We need heavy infantry of our own to counter them," I sighed, "and I don't happen to have any. Not unless we can build them out of stone."
"How about bags of dirt?"
offered Rundal, hesitantly. "What do you mean?" I asked. I didn't dismiss the lad. He was smart. Smarter than a hobgoblin, in any case. If he saw something I didn't, I wanted to know.
"How about earth elementals?"
he suggested. "Post them on the trail, and it would be hard for even the hobs to make it past them."
"We do have plenty of dirt," Carmella said, amused. "The elementals might be good for moving it. They aren't very good at fighting. They can't maintain cohesiveness for long enough to be effective. Once they lose their material, they're just an enneagram with no place to go."
"What if something else held their material together?" asked Rondal thoughtfully.
"Conserved their mass and kept them cohesive."
"Another spell?"
Penny asked, intrigued.
"No," Rondal said, shaking his head. "Not what I had in mind." "Oh, well, maybe, but I don't think we have time to experiment with that, under the circumstances. I did this spell once that used an earth elemental, but... Say, Master, do you think you could get us some empty sacks?"
I thought of the huge shed stacked full of the hundreds of bags of flour my father's bakery had already run through, back in Talri. Gareth could transport them here easily.
"Yes, but... why?" "Well, can any of these ladies sew?"
he asked pointlessly. The Kasari girls prided themselves on their needlework the way the boys did on their wood carving. Every time we stopped to rest, nearly every Kasari girl whipped out some patch of needlework they were working on, while the Kasari boys carved wood with their knives. Because if we do this right, I might just have a way to conjure some heavy infantry. Rondal's plan was a good one, especially as it didn't require anyone getting hurt. Gareth sent us a huge stack of sacks and bags from my father's surplus, and the rest of the morning a squadron of young Kasari women eagerly stitched them together under Rondal's direction. Once he explained the principle to us, I had to agree that it was a simple and elegant solution to the problem. But it was only part of the problem. Elemental cohesiveness is difficult to manage for earth elementals, but that was only one reason they were rarely employed as weapons. They are the least aggressive and active of the elementals, good for work, but as belligerent as a turtle. I could help with that by using the grain of pores. While Rondal oversaw the sewing, I sat in my tent and studied the tiny shard of ghost rock and the thousands of enneagrammatic impressions it held. Most thaumaturges understand the principles of enneagrammatic magic. I was one of the few who had successfully conjured one of each type. I had never met someone who had managed a fire elemental the way I had at the Battle of Timberwatch. But as I allowed my mind to descend into the depths of the grain, I began to understand why that tiny stone held such power. There were things within, the remnants of creatures so ancient they had no names. Some were like fishes, others like crustaceans, or even avian predators, and some were so wild and strange I had no idea from what kind of nervous system they had sprung. A few I could roughly identify by the patterns of their enneagrams. Predators tend to share certain characteristics, for example, as do scavengers, and some I had no discernible function that I could tell. After a few hours of steady work, however, I was able to identify and locate entities within the grain that I felt could be useful in our situation. They also gave me some ideas for amending Rondal's basic creation. The standard arcane templates for earth elementals were embarrassingly basic compared to the complex patterns within the grain. Transferring the enneagram from the grain was difficult, without a full thaumaturgical laboratory, but I've done it before. I was starting to get good at it. By afternoon, we had a working prototype lumbering across the ridge, and several more were under construction. The girls were glad to be able to do something other than fetch water for the archers and practice rolling bandages with the priestesses. Sewing their way out of a battle seemed exciting. While we had been crafting enchantments, the rangers had been busy. Those not grabbing a precious few hours of sleep before the inevitable nocturnal assault were harassing the foe in countless ways. Sentries had their throats slit. Kasari snipers slew goblin officers in the midst of giving orders. Thaumaturgical distractions interrupted vital intelligence reports, and Dara's skyriders, who could do little at night when their diurnal birds were essentially blind, harassed the encampment from the air all day long. But that evening, when Frightful was back to her proper size and resting on her perch in my tent, Dara took a nap until dark, then prepared the thoughtful knife. It had no trouble seeing in the dark. Just after our magical kettles appeared with supper, river fish stew with bacon this time, we got another call of truce down at the first gate. Mask, herself, wanted to speak to who was in charge. I walked to the second gate to meet our foe, after I wolfed down a bowl of stew and a heel of bread. Brother Hotfoot and Arborn both accompanied me, to represent the Kasari and the refugees, respectively. The gate was crowded with determined-looking rangers, scared-looking militiamen, their knuckles white on their spear shafts, and Ormar and Landric, who had been largely healed of their wounds by our magical medic. Ormar had a pyramid of parchment-wrapped alchemical devices at hand, ready to deploy. The former censorate war mage had augmented his battle axe with a mage blade and a crossbow. Both looked ready to get back into the fray after their refreshing respite. Mask and her ugly retinue were waiting halfway between the first and second gatehouses, behind a tall stone, where the trail widened slightly, permitting more than one person to stand on it at a time. While within bowshot, she did not seem to fear our shafts, nor did the hobgoblins behind her seem ready to attack under a battlefield truce. I had to commend the Gervani. They had yet to break a truce, to my knowledge, something that few human lords could say. I had no intention of breaking it. I honestly wanted to hear what she had to say. Mask was accompanied by three aides, two standard-issue Gavani, dressed in light infantry or cavalry armor, and a hobgoblin bearing the Bloody Root's obscene black and red banner at the end of a pike. The hob's armor was every bit as good as human manufacture, a cast-iron breastplate secured with thick leather straps. He wore vambraces and greaves of iron as well, and leather gauntlets, sewn with iron plates, grasped the thick shaft of the pike with familiarity. His helm was the most impressive, far more complex than the simple iron cap that most Gavani infantry wore. It mimicked a human style of great helmet. The sophisticated, rounded crown was designed to deflect glancing blows, while a thick faceplate and a metal gorget protected his thick neck and ugly face from ear to furry ear. The helm had savage-looking guards projecting in front, like boar's tusks, to guard the face and eyes from harm. The hob's shoulders were covered with thick iron pauldrons attached to the straps of his breastplate, as stout as any human mercenary. A short, wide sword, without adornment, hung at his belt. The Bloody Root was no joke. In my professional opinion, that armor was built for serious infantry work. The scars on the hob's face and arms bore testament to his experience, too, and the eyes betrayed his history. His eyes flashed eerily with a fierce ring of bright copper pigment around his irises. That was a killer's stone face. If Mask wanted to impress me with her bodyguard, she had. Mask herself was a slight woman, shorter than even Penny, though she wore equestrian boots with a high heel to make her appear taller. As it was, she was not much larger than her goblin aides, and shorter than the hobgoblin, who wasn't quite 6 feet tall without his helm. She had a billowing dark mantle around her, covering her hair and adding to her presence. The cowl over her head cast her eyes in shadow, while the thick veil of leather that gave her war name to her seemed to form a toothy grimace in the gloom. She wore light but sturdy leather armor, the style favored by many Wenshari war magi, reinforced in vulnerable areas with steel, but darkened to keep it from reflecting at night. There was a mage blade on her back, a wickedly curved design popular with the Cormeran war magi, and she bore a staff her own height. Weirwood, I could see, and at its summit was set a witchstone, a big one. Despite her cool repose, a glance with mage sight revealed the staff to be the center of a wide, comprehensive defensive net of spells. She might not be ready to break the truce, but she was ready if I did. I could respect that. She struck a defiant pose when she saw us approach. She was arrogant, I could tell, and not a little vain. Those were good qualities in a fearless leader, and weaknesses I could potentially exploit. Here was a woman concerned for her position. My intuition told me, a woman with something to prove to someone. "Hail the besiegers," I called as I came within earshot. "What names shall we call you?"
"You may call me Lady Mask," she said haughtily, her voice distorted just a bit by magic. "These are my lands you trespass upon."
"I don't seem to recall seeing your name in the Hall of Records with the associated documents," I chuckled. "Even right of conquest has to be secured by application. At the very least, these lands are in contention."
"Insolent wizard," she sneered. "My defense of my claim is all the application I require. You have no right to bring that rabble here and pretend to build a castle on my doorstep," she said, annoyed, as she glanced up at the scaffolded tower. "A clever illusion, but it will not deter my soldiery from driving you out."
"Your soldiery will receive a rude surprise, then, if they ever gain those walls," I observed. "That is no illusion, my lady. That is a permanent fortification, and we've managed to keep building throughout your quaint little assaults. We expect it to be finished in a few days," I added. "If you could toddle off until we're done." I could only see her eyes above her veil by mage sight, but they turned dark and skeptical as she snorted derisively.
"Impossible! It takes years to build a castle."
"Not when you have motivated workers, clever engineers, and a wheelbarrow full of magic, I pointed out. I'm just that good. That tower is here, and here it will stay.
Perhaps, she said threateningly, but it will be my Gavanni who garrison it, not humans. Your blood will be used to affix its foundations after I storm the place.
Already done, I promised, and I really doubt that's going to happen. She laughed coldly, glancing back at her hobgoblin guard.
I have a full company of bloody root infantry ready to storm this gate,
and I have a couple of 100 12-year-olds up there who look forward to being entertained, watching them fail. I smiled. My lady, if brute force could accomplish your goal, you would have won the day already. Instead of one small landing, you spent hundreds conquering. I jibed.
The day is nearly done, she replied evenly. We will win the night.
We have sent for further reinforcements, she boasted, as if that settled the matter.
Oh, so have we,
I agreed lightly, and we have only just begun our magical defences. You really haven't even gotten to the good ones yet, sadly. My lads were curious to see how you would contend with them. But I do appreciate the effort. It's helping us refine them, under field conditions. One rarely has that luxury during construction. She glowered at me.
What is your name, Warmage?
She demanded. Minolan the Spellmonger, I replied, as I silently directed the witch sphere to rise behind my shoulder with what I hoped was a proper amount of menace. I have a lot of titles, but that's my name. Her eyes got as big as round shields. Apparently she'd heard of me.
You,
she said in a harsh whisper. I may have been mistaken, but I thought the goblins exchanged worried looks at the mention. Non-human faces are hard to read sometimes, particularly through helmets.
The infamous spellmonger.
You have confounded our great lord's desires at every turn. Well, I've certainly tried, I agreed. It's nice to know I'm starting to get the recognition I deserve. I could hear Arborn and Brother Hotfoot stifle laughter behind me at her expression. As a courtesy, I should mention you've become somewhat of a legend yourself among my folk. Though you are far cuter than our spies reported, I said, deliberately trying to infuriate her. I was partially successful.
It will be a pleasure and a service to the old god when I take your head, she proposed with a deliberate hiss. Lady Mask will succeed where so many others have failed.
I got closer, causing the goblins to back up, but not the hobgoblin. The eunuch looked on, unconcerned, merely awaiting orders. Lady Mask, to her credit, appeared unafraid. Your ambition does you credit, my lady, but there is a reason that all those others failed. Despite your blaster, you are overmatched.
My army is as large as your army,
she boasted contemptuously.
My warriors are soaked in the blood of their foes. They hunger for the flesh of Narasi knights. We will not allow such a large force of warriors to establish itself so near our frontier.
Knights, I scoffed. There are few knights here, Lady Mask. I lead an army of children.
What?
She snorted in disbelief. Children, I repeated, the same ones who, with a little help, have managed to fight your soldiers all day while continuing to build the tower and practice their letters and knots. Oh, and they've been doing a lot of sewing, too, while your soldiers go hungry for the taste of knight's flesh.
I don't believe you,
she scoffed, but looked up at the new battlements uncertainly. You don't have to, I shrugged. I just thought you'd like to know what you're up against. As you said, I've defeated many of Shirul's champions. I've escaped from his clutches. I've bested every warrior he sent against me. This time, I get the amusement of achieving a victory using children.
I am not like anyone you have faced,
she snarled defiantly. You will fare no better, my lady, I dismissed. You underestimate me, as they did, and I warn you. Crossing staves with me would see you fail utterly.
I do not fail,
she insisted, her eyes defiant over her mask. She shifted her staff to interpose it between us. The big witch stone within glowed eerily with power in the gloom, though she made no move to activate a spell. She was just showing off her power.
I will see you dead and all your works ruined.
You will slink away with your tail between your legs, if you survive at all.
Arborn called out, I have known the spellmonger a short time. I have never known him to lose a contest. Those bold words were heartening, but they also raised the level of expectation and hardened her resolve.
I could tear that peasant's shack down by myself, she spat, her eyes glancing above. Our truce is over, spellmonger. Beware, lest I call you out in a duel and you show everyone just how your reputation serves you better than your enchantments.
I studied her intently. Best you don't, my little lady, I said, emphasizing the little. The last time I drew my sword and rode to battle against Gavanni, 100,000 of them lost their lives, yet I thrive. I cast my eye on her staff. It was potent. The shard of Irionite was twice as large as most of my magi carried, and it pulsed with the spell she had hung around it.
Do your worst, she said,
her eyes narrowing. I could feel her combat spells activating. I'd rather do my best, I said, quoting the Kasari motto. I reached out and grasped her staff, probably the last thing she expected, and I whispered a mnemonic to myself. A spell activated. The deadly thing disappeared into a pocket dimension attached to a ring I wore. I hadn't thought it would be that easy, but it just vanished out of her clutching fingers like anything else I wanted to put there. Of course, so did the spell she had powered with it. She stared at me furiously, her eyes wide with shock. Now let's watch you try to assault us without the toy, I said contemptuously. As you said, do your worst. We'll do our best. I'll be waiting at the top. I turned and walked away, unconcerned with the strangled cries of frustration and anger behind me as she tried to contain her rage.
Are you certain that was wise, spellmonger?
Brother Hotfoot asked, amused but concerned, as he tried to keep up with my and Arborn's longer strides. Arborn was looking back dourly at the goblins and their mistress as they sullenly retreated behind the first gateway, his great bow in hand and an arrow knocked, but not drawn. He seemed to dare them to attack us as we withdrew.
Wise, I mused.
Absolutely not, but strategically valuable. Now she's enraged and bereft of her greatest source of magic. A goodly portion of battle is taking advantages of your enemy's mistakes.
I just gave her a couple of good reasons to make some. Still, an infuriated enemy can be unpredictable,
Hotfoot replied.
You don't know what she might do.
It was my turn to snort. What is she going to do? Kill us even harder? Darkness was falling fast as we walked back up to the top of the ridge, and I had to cast a mage light to see my footing. When we arrived, Rondol was stretching after his labors.
All is ready, master, he called, kicking the edge of his construction with the toe of his boot. The last Skyrider patrol returned from her mission just as the sun set. No more serious reinforcements will arrive tonight. They're all in now.
Good, I nodded as I surveyed his work. 9 of them, all together, some as big as trolls, were stretched out on the grassy meadow atop the ridge. Lady Mask had her heavy infantry. I now had mine. They look splendid. Get them ready to deploy. The big one on the trail, the others in waiting. Let's see how long it takes for them to get through one before we spend them all.
That's some classy enchantment,
Carmella agreed. She'd just arrived from overseeing the laying of the final rafter joists at the top of the tower.
Tough, resilient, disposable. You know, there's more than one way to deploy them, she added, looking at Rondal slyly.
She explained her plan to us, and I had to agree. It had merit. Do it, I ordered. Start with 2. Then let's see what happens. It's not like we can't get more bags and more dirt if we need it.
Yes, spellmonger,
she said, with a rare grin. Carmella hardly gets excited by anything that wasn't a construction problem to be solved, but she did enjoy testing her theories in battle,
Most of us did. This is going to be more fun than Timberwatch, she sighed, as she drew a wand. That had been the last major battle in which such engines and strategy like this had been used. That had been Carmella's masterpiece, proving her value to all as a defensive war mage of highest regard. Most of the Kasari children were being called to bed by their horn calls, almost unconcerned with the battle around them. Some of the older lads, those who had taken the life oath, volunteered to stand guard or assist with the defense on the walls with their bows. The Sisters of Brigga were manning the canopy that served as a field hospital, and the hundreds of hard-working kids who had toiled on the tower or sewed madly while the battle raged below were ending their workday. I was hopeful. The inspired move to steal Lady Mask's magical staff had made me confident. Without that power at her command, she was an ordinary war mage. Reporting its loss to her superiors in the Umbra would be painful at best, even if she won. No one was getting that staff back unless I wanted them to have it. I was in the middle of a mirror call to Alia, explaining the situation and assuring her of my safety, when the drums started up again, echoing across the ridges. A horn call, much deeper and more menacing than the Kasari's brass instruments, shook the veil, echoing in dramatic fashion. The night's attack had begun. Chapter 15. The Legacy of Pores. The drums thundered all night long, a monotonous rhythm by which the Gavani timed their assault. One after another, they charged up the trail, screaming and shouting war cries as they tried to gain the second gatehouse. Many fell to arrows and stones lobbed from the trail above, though they held up shields to cover their heads. Others were impaled on spears or thrown off the trail by cunning Kasari rope tricks. Throughout it all, the Gavani rumbled a guttural chant in time to the rhythm of the drums that kept them propelled toward violent death. When Rondol's enchantment was ready, we were ready to start some noise of our own. It took four big Kasari youth to lug it down the trail between assaults, but once it was in place, my apprentice spoke the words of command and activated the artifact. It came to life and stood on its stumpy legs. Call it the descendant of the Clayman of Pores. It rose, an 8-foot-tall, bulging scarecrow. It contained a staff of oak for a spine and springy evergreen boughs for legs, its flesh the soil of the land, lightly seasoned with snow sand, enchantment, and sophisticated spellwork. Its skin was three layers of burlap, tightly stitched together, and bound with belts and straps for added stability. An iron helmet, too small for its unseeing head, was placed upon the top, ostensibly to protect the integrity of the burlap. But mostly it was a decorative measure, as was the hastily painted face, a clownish grimace with crazy-looking eyes that stared balefully from under the helmet. Instead of dirt, the bags that comprised the construct's long, tube-like arms had been covered with tough leather and filled with gravel, stones the size of a man's eye, about 30 pounds in each massive mitt, and there were four of them. It had occurred to me while I was poking around in the Grain of Pores that most of the entity's enneagrams I encountered were not built along the two-arms, two-legs design. Indeed, most of them had no need of legs as such, or if they did, they weren't used like we'd use them. But the dexterity suggested by their enneagrams convinced me to select some patterns that had a facility with multiple limbs. As a result, our largest dirt bag construct was created with four stubby clubs for hands, not two. It would prove an interesting experiment in battlefield magic. When Rondol activated and animated the construct at the gatehouse, it pulled itself erect in a jerking mockery of life. But it was a lot more lifelike than your typical earth elemental. It hulked there, barely moving, as Rondol checked its cohesiveness and obedience. Then he gave the construct its arcane instructions. There's a lot of technical jargon I could fill your ears with, but Rondol essentially told the long-dead sea creature that its eggs, stashed up on the ridge, were in danger from the predators, the goblins, on the trail. That's all it took. With far more alacrity than I'd ever seen an elemental display, the construct trundled forward into the darkness, impelled by nature's command to protect its young.
Not even the gods know the form or fashion of the original creature, but whatever form it once enjoyed, it was apparently used to using its limbs as weapons. As it came to the first group of cowering goblins, it soundlessly regarded them before it methodically began tearing them apart. The arms on each side acted in concert, like pincers, and grasped the goblins before squeezing them to death, beating them, or throwing them over the side of the steep path. It was an eerily beautiful, utterly horrible sight, illuminated by mage light. The goblins were quick to confront the thing and tried desperately to stab at it with their swords and spears. Arrows peppered it, and it ignored them. The construct did not react the way a living thing would when struck. It could not tell when its thick burlap skin was punctured, or when a mace crashed against its torso. It had no capacity for feeling pain. But it still had an aggressive sense of self-preservation, and a mission to protect its young. Any foe who got within reach received a pounding from 2 30-pound bags of leather-wrapped gravel. Not many cast-iron goblin helmets could withstand that, nor goblin heads. One by one, the infantry, who faced it, died in brutal fashion, until the front ranks broke and ran, colliding with those who pushed up from behind. Near the far end of the trail, near the first gatehouse, Mask's regular troops gave way to the veterans of the Bloody Root as they advanced to confront the new threat. The hobgoblins bravely stood their ground against the construct and used their wicked pole arms to try to block its flailing limbs. It was an impressive display of battlefield cooperation. Working in concert, they pinned one, then two, of the club-like appendages with the hafts of the halberds, while others struggled to pin the other side without being bashed to death or thrown off the ledge. They were partially successful. They managed to wedge enough of them between the slope and the construct to pry it loose from the trail, sending it tumbling down the slope and into their unsuspecting fellows on the lower trail. While the hobgoblins in the vanguard cheered, their fellows in the second company were suddenly being attacked by an even angrier and confused construct that saw threats to its eggs all around. The great limbs went into a frenzy, flying in a near panic as it tried to recover. It took a heavy toll on the hobs it hammered. Even as the vanguard turned to race up the trail to the second gatehouse, Rundal spoke another command word, and the second construct rose to life. This one was different, even less anthropomorphic. It was more like a two-headed ram on 4 feet, with a lower center of gravity. The crab-like thing I had chosen to harness to the elemental template had a seriously belligerent temper, I assumed a mating cycle, or just general hostility that made it want to bash things really hard. We'd facilitated that natural inclination by arming its 2 fake ram's horns with thick iron jousting helmets, well secured with leather straps and spiked on the crowns. When the crab beast construct was set loose, it charged into the hobs to even greater effect than the first. The relentless grip of its 4 legs on the trail gave it plenty of leverage to swing its horns to sweep the goblins off the trail, once it had charged into them and sent them sprawling. Satisfied with the dance of magical violence my apprentice had incited, and glad that it wasn't being witnessed by most of the children at this hour, I let Rondol direct the counter-assault, while I went up to the battlements to oversee the next phase of our defense. Carmella's makeshift trebuchets were ready to lob more missiles over the side of the ridge and into the besieging army below. Without her witchstone, Lady Mask's protection against such things were weakened, and these weren't mere rocks. These were very special missiles. "It's a good thing they don't have any bones to break in the fall," Sir Festaren chuckled, as he helped fold up the limp bags of earth we'd meticulously prepared for the assault and place them in the engine's coils. "You say the creatures, they're patterned after Hadnan?" "I couldn't say for certain," I admitted, "but I think they had legs. A lot of legs. I'm sure it looked like nothing we're experienced with." I nodded, as the multi-legged constructs we'd fashioned were put into place. "Wait," Tyndall said, as we were about to fire the siege weapons. "I almost forgot. I added a little extra enchantment." He grinned. He muttered a few words and cast a quick spell. From each of the construct's heads, a single mage light of surpassing brightness suddenly beamed. "There," he said, satisfied. "The scrags have a hard time with bright light. Let's see how they fight something they can't look at directly."
"They're ready, then," Carmela said with an amused smile. "Let's see what they can do. Clear the area, all at once. Fire!" she called to the crews. Three Karshak hammers slapped at their blocks, letting the heavy stone counterweights plummet to the ground, while the three limp forms were flung in a harsh arc out over the side of the mountain and down into the darkness below. We all watched the spinning light of the constructs as they fell. It must have looked incredible from the ground, until they landed. I activated the constructs while they were in the air, and moments after they crunched to the ground, I used mage sight to watch them fight. They responded to the goblins around them like crazed insects, defending themselves. Their many appendages lashed out to strike at everything they could reach as they spun through the surprised army. Each one of the sheep-sized, insanely hostile constructs had sharp iron spear points, which we'd recovered from the fallen goblins, affixed to some of their appendages. Magic animated wooden limbs and earthen muscle to slash and stab with frightening speed, their brilliantly glowing eyes illuminating their victims. The goblins did their best to respond to the sudden appearance of the fierce, frightening constructs, but they took no more notice of their wounds than their fellows on the ledge. They could still be defeated. Broken wood could not support them, and bags of dirt eventually emptied. But it took the goblins great energy and effort, and a lot of unexpected casualties. Just as the first of our constructs fell, as the Gavanni congregated to face the threat, I ordered Dara to launch the Thoughtful Knife, to give them something else to fear. She spent an hour or so zipping through the mass of goblins who had assembled to fight the constructs, supporting the attack from the air with bloody efficiency. There were limits to how long a human mind could control the thing, however, and after she finished ruining Lady Mask's headquarters tent, far beyond bowshot, I made her call off her assault and put the knife away for the night. She needed sleep. The sudden attack in their camp broke the goblins' resolve to charge up the trail, as they were recalled to confront the assault, and for a time all below was in blissful chaos. Bodies of goblins and hobgoblins lay everywhere. The wounded wailed and howled for help, and the survivors struggled through the night to maintain the discipline not to desert. "Oh, they look so hopeful. Let's give them a second volley," I suggested, when only one remained. "Over there, towards their headquarters tent. What's left of it?" As rugged as they were, our improvised arcane constructs were eventually defeated. Enough axes and swords, slashing at the burlap and leather of the constructs, caused them to lose their material and bend their enchantments. Lady Mask had to come out and lead the counterattack, finally using war magic to defeat the last spindly-legged construct just yards from her tent. Our arcane servants were defeated. But they had done their job. In 3 or 4 hours they had left hundreds of Gavanni dead and wounded, dashed their encampment, and seriously challenged Lady Mask's resolve. Along with Dara's mayhem with the Thoughtful Knife, the sun rose over a very chaotic and battered goblin army. "That was bloody awful," Mage Lord Sefestaran said admirably, as we gathered around the edge of the cliff to watch the aftermath. Dawn was breaking, and the Kasari horns called the children to wake for the day. Sefes had his arm over Dara's shoulder, warming her with his cloak and keeping her upright after her busy night. The knife really was exhausting work. "About 417 casualties. At least another 226 wounded," he pronounced with satisfaction. "Nearly a third of their force incapacitated, the rest demoralized." "We'll see if they slink away when the sun comes up," I speculated. "I'm not hopeful. We may have just pissed them off. Why don't you see Lady Dara to her tent and then grab some sleep yourself? I don't think we'll need to repel any storming parties this morning."
"Master, it seems awfully wrong of her to be besieging our camp when her home is sitting there, virtually unprotected," Dara pointed out sleepily. "It's only 12-15 miles away, just this side of the river. When we flew over it, we saw hardly any guards left. It was mostly slaves. She left just a skeleton garrison," she pointed out with a yawn. "It would be a shame if something terribly unfortunate were to happen to her castle while she was out fighting us."
"Master, I like the way Dara thinks," Tyndall agreed with a grin. "Coming home to a broken keep and a slave uprising,
after you just got routed on the field, is a special kind of indignity.
You think you could start a slave revolt? I asked, amused.
I've done it before, he shrugged. It doesn't take much. Some weapons, some leadership, and some opportunity. The faint hope of escape lends a man a desperate strength. It's quite fascinating, from a professional perspective.
Prepare your party, then, I agreed. We'll pay a little visit to the hall of Lady Mask. Then I went to take a nap, with instructions to wake me if anything important happened. Thankfully, I slept until Sir Festaron woke me, just before the sun reached its zenith. The horns were sounding the call to luncheon, and I felt like porridge. That's the crappy thing about fighting goblins. It really throws off your sleep schedule. I could see the councils of our foe meeting outside the ruins of Lady Mask's tent while I ate the meal my patrol brought me. Her commanders angrily demanded she do something about the belligerent bags of dirt that were beating them into a pulp. Mask pleaded and demanded and begged, and in the end her officers grudgingly agreed to give her another opportunity to win the day. Fresh troops arrived that afternoon, having been force-marched through the brightest part of the day. Not more hobgoblins we could see, but a few hundred spindly-legged Gavanni with ropes and hooks.
They're going to try to come up the slope,
Carmela said, shaking her head as she sipped her morning tea.
That's suicide. Does she still think it's some kind of illusion?
The spells on that slope are no illusion, said Master Morton, the Hessian Order's war mage that Carmela had decided would be in charge of the tower when it was complete.
An older Castali war mage, who'd spent most of his time in the lower Riverlands, such defensive enchantments were a specialty of his. Master Morten was resolute, the kind of intense, unwavering war mage you want on your side in a siege. Morten had spent a great deal of time enchanting the slopes around the ridge to deter just this sort of attack while the tower was being built.
The first line is just annoying, he explained to me and the other war magi. They'll soil themselves and vomit and fear for their lives for no reason. If they get past the first line, the second will kill them, or make them wish they were dead. I plan to make this tower impregnable, he declared. I'm not likely to allow that sort of simple attack on our flanks.
Mask hasn't had a lot of experience against other war magi, I reminded them. From what little we know, she's adept at imperial magic, and with a witchstone she's deadly. But she's mostly been tested against non-magical foes, where she has an advantage. Now that she's up against opponents who can counter her sorceries, she's flailing. And without her witchstone. The battle died down during the day, as Mask tried to put her camp back in order. For the most part, we left them alone to count their dead and recover with just a few sniper attacks to keep them awake and nervous. The first gatehouse had been retaken after a rally and counterattack led by Ormar and Landrig, and Rondal was working to refortify and strengthen it against tonight's inevitable offensive. Instead of the constructs, during the day, two giant dogs sat on the trail and growled menacingly at the goblin sentries at the other end of the trail. Meanwhile, Dara and her wing of giant hawks took flight that afternoon and winged their way west. It didn't take long for Dara to find the site of Mask's fortress, complete with her ugly banner, and confirmed the presence of but a few sleepy guards and overseers. Over 100 slaves were being used to tend the scraggly fields of grain and vegetables, and the few herds of goats and pigs the castle still maintained. Our attack was straightforward, if sneaky. Dara sat down in an empty corner of the bailey and dropped a waystone on the ground. When she informed me all was ready, mind to mind, I used magic to take myself and a small squadron through to the decrepit keep. The depressing squat tower Mask had appropriated was old but sturdy, made of tightly fitted rubble and lacking much in the way of aesthetics. It was one of scores of such fortresses the Wilderlords had built during the initial settlement of the Northern Dales, and it loomed over the domain like an imposing creditor. The castle village sat within the bailey, making it easier to both defend and oppress. Dara's field observations had been correct. There were less than a dozen Gavanni left inside, my scrying showed. I'd brought Tyndall and Sir Festaron as well as two rangers to help. That had hurt. Taking four people through the waypoints was difficult, and five was extremely hard. My head hurt with the effort, but I felt I had to push myself to practice. I looked at my senior apprentice, who was surveying the keep with a discerning eye, and a worried expression, as dizziness washed over me. A good time to depend on the services of my vassals and liegemen, I decided.
Sir Festaren, which of those corners would you estimate is the weakest? I asked, curious about the scope and extent of the lad's magical abilities.
The southeast corner, Mage Lord, the young knight answered almost at once. It is lower than the other three by 5 inches at least, likely built on a poor foundation which settled unevenly, he said critically. It's too easy to drive and undermine into.
The Wilderlords prefer storming parties to sapping, I chuckled. The ground is too rocky around here to make that productive in most cases. Tyndall, you have your weakness. Take down that castle, please.
My pleasure, master, he said, grinning.
It's not often a war mage gets that kind of opportunity or blanket permission for wanton destruction. He considered for a few moments, then began constructing an elaborate but efficient spell. It was professionally gratifying to witness him building the layers of enchantment in the proper imperial-approved manner, and when he was done, he looked at me for final permission. I nodded. He spoke a command, in a loud and somewhat boastful tone, and a high-pitched whine began. In moments, the lowest corner of the square keep began to rise up, and up, until it was level with other sides. And it kept going. In a few moments, the rocks that made up the wall fell away from each other, their mortar broken, and the entire side of the keep collapsed, taking a good measure of wall on either side of the corner along with it, in a catastrophic crash.
Well done, Sir Festaren approved, while Dara giggled.
A cloud of dust had erupted with the corner's collapse. The keep erupted with activity as the surviving goblins, sleeping within, began to shake themselves out of the rubble, coughing and choking and squealing in pain and confusion. To them, the late afternoon was the equivalent of the depths of night to us. The village full of human slaves next to the keep, filled with poor wretches alerted by the sound. "Let's go speak to these good folks," I suggested. Leaving the giant falcon behind us, we walked calmly through the grass of the yard as the giant dust cloud from the collapse began to dissipate. We reached the edge of the village to find a crowd of gawking slaves staring at the ruined castle.
"You know," Tyndall remarked casually as we came up behind the wretches, "there probably aren't more than a few guards left alive in there," he said to a knot of onlookers. "It probably won't take much to overwhelm them and take the gates."
"Who are you?"
asked a middle-aged man in a filthy hempen smock and a thick iron collar around his neck.
"Did the lady send you?"
he asked, terrified, in a Gilmoran accent. "Not on purpose, but we are here because of her," I explained. "She's busy attacking me elsewhere, so we thought we'd give you the opportunity to take advantage of her absence and escape."
"Escape?" he scoffed. "My lord, the lands around here crawl with her riders. Those damn hounds of hers can sniff out a human anywhere we hide. And what she does to those who get caught, she experiments on them with her sorcery. Besides, no one knows where the lady went or how far away she is. She could return at any time," he insisted, fearfully.
"I have it on excellent authority that she's currently engaged more than a dozen miles from here," I said. "At the quickest, she couldn't be back here before a day, and her attention is rather occupied at the moment. It might take much longer."
"So we should just walk away?" the man scoffed.
A small crowd had gathered around us. We clearly weren't slaves, and while they were fearful of the consequences of speaking with us, their curiosity won out.
"Well, take what you can carry, Goodman," suggested Sir Festaren. "Loot to your heart's content, but escape. Today, all of you, go south for a ways, then east. There is a new fortress built about 13 2/7 miles from here, up on a high ridge. Find that keep and you will find rescue within. Perhaps even find your way back home," he promised. "But certainly you will not die here in this depressing place."
"We can't fight without weapons,"
complained a man who looked like he was searching for a reason to believe us. I could see how he might be skeptical. I was ready for that. I had as many loose Gavanni weapons collected from the battle on the trail as I could. Most of the armor went to reinforcing the constructs who were still protecting us, but the weapons included many sturdy, if ugly, iron knives and swords, as well as dozens of those little maces most of the traditional Gavanni still carried as a personal weapon.
I opened a magical huckster pocket from Trailblazer and dumped the pile of nasty-looking blades at their feet.
Oh, look what fell out of my pocket.